Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, scholar Christopher W. Hunt discusses his recent book, Jimmy's Faith, James Baldwin, Disidentification, and the Queer Possibilities of Black Religion. This conversation originally took place September 16th, 2025, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. This exhibit and our programming series explores the profound ways writing reflects and influences our understanding of religion. American Prophets is now open. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome, I'm Carrie Cranston. I'm the president here at the American Writers Museum. This program is part of a series called American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. This series of programs is leading up to an exhibit that will open here in the museum that will look at everything from memoir and poetry to science fiction and song, and the influence of religion on American writers and the influence of American writers on religion, which makes the book we're about to hear about even more timely. So, to that end, here to speak with us about the subject is Dr. Christopher Hunt, assistant professor of religion at Colorado College. He received his PhD from Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary. Dr. Hunt's work considers the relevance and meaning of Black religion for those on the margins or considered outside of traditional religious spaces. He'll be interviewed by Dr. Ivy Wilson, who teaches courses on comparative literature of the Black diaspora and U.S. literary studies, with a particular emphasis on African-American culture at Northwestern University. Dr. Wilson is also a member of the American Writers Museum Board of Directors, and I want to welcome you both.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
How's it feel a bit in Chicago?
I love Chicago. I'm currently in Colorado Springs, so it's a very stark difference between Chicago and Colorado Springs. So
in what ways?
Oh,
let me guess. Baldwin has a story about this, but it's not Colorado.
Exactly.
It's Switzerland.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I think I hear you.
Yeah. So it's so nice to step off the plane and see so much melanin in one space, when in Colorado Springs, you can go a week and not see anyone that looks like you.
Not a small amount here tonight. It's great to see everyone in the crowd. So we're really delighted to welcome you here.
Thank you.
On the occasion of the book, it's a really smart one. I had a chance to read two chapters today. And you know, I don't want this conversation to be overly academic, but I do want to ask a question about how you came to the project, why now? Many universities have departments of religious studies. Theology is also a strong component here in the U.S. There are very famous and very important scholars of religion, working in Black religions in particular. Let's say like Cornel West, for example, or James Cohen, or Judith Weisenfeld, or Anthea Butler, like our own Sylvester Johnson. Let's say six of the country's top scholars in this area, but little of them take up the issue or the topic of Black queer life. And so I wonder if you could just say a little bit about the arc of how you landed here as an academic.
Yes, that's an excellent question. So I first began to revisit Baldwin in graduate school. I had read pieces of Baldwin here and there as I was coming of age. And a friend of mine recommended to me, you need to read Baldwin again. Because at the time I'm in a theological seminary, and I'm a Black queer person in a theological seminary, and a person who was beginning to question whether or not the Christian faith was appropriate for me anymore. And so this friend said, you need Baldwin. So I walked over to the Northwestern Library, grabbed a copy of The Fire Next Time, and it was absolutely transformational, changed my life. And the reason why it changed my life was because here I am, I'm sitting in these classes and I'm learning about the history of, you know, the academic study of religion. I'm learning about theology, all these things in the classroom. And I'm asking the question of why are Black religion scholars not engaging Baldwin more? And then I realized, oh, as I'm reading someone like James Cohen, who famously wrote Black Theology and Black Power, A Black Theology of Liberation, God of the Oppressed, right? If you haven't read Cohen, you absolutely should read Cohen. But I realized reading Cohen, Baldwin's all over this, even if he's not necessarily citing Baldwin. And I'm like, well, I wonder why that is. And so I began to read everything Baldwin that I possibly could, and also reading other writers who were engaging Baldwin. And I came to the conclusion that those who were engaging questions about Baldwin and spirituality, I was being left unsatisfied by their conclusions. I think there's some excellent work out there, phenomenal, that I absolutely leaned on in writing my own text. But I began to think, some authors wanted to say that Baldwin was in essence a kind of closet Christian, despite the fact that he disavowed his faith. And I said, I don't think that's the case. Other folks said, well, Baldwin was kind of using religious rhetoric and symbols as a kind of rhetorical flourish in his work. And I also thought that's not the case either. And so I began to think Baldwin is doing something else. And so the entirety of my book is, in essence, about that something else.
I want to just all like linger on the question of like Baldwin and spirituality. Mm-hmm. It's not quite the same thing as Christianity, not quite the same thing as theology. But, you know, there is a way to think about Baldwin's description of sex and desire as a kind of spirituality. So not just kind of ribald, visceral, physical, but the ways in which one is enlivened and brought to a different state of being. Mm-hmm. And so many of his novels, so many of his stories are really encapsulated with a kind of deep entwining that is kind of organized around sex. But we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. He kind of jumped a cue here around the fire next time. So why don't we just go there? Because we're here in Chicago, and the fire next time is, I'm someone who thinks that, you know, Baldwin is an exquisite writer and could levitate. But I actually think his essays are quite exquisite. And maybe he might have even been a better essayist than he was a fiction writer. That's just my opinion. But one of the most important, clearly, is The Fire Next Time. It's for those of you who are unfamiliar with it, it's a very short volume built around two letters, a letter from the dungeon, a letter from the region of my mind.
A letter from the region of my mind.
Yeah. And the frontispiece is actually written to his nephew, who is also named James. And he is writing it, and he's telling his nephew that your father was defeated before you were born. And he's trying to tell his dear nephew that he remembers a version of his father that no longer exists. He remembers a beauty, an essence, a black aliveness that had been destroyed by the kind of vicissitudes of American life. But he's telling this story to his nephew on the heels, and so the subtitle of that is on the 100th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation. Mm-hmm. And we're set to kind of live. So let me just, like, there's one part here, and let me just begin with the title, The Fire Next Time, which is, you know, from a very, one of the kind of canons of the Black American gospel tradition. Mm-hmm. For those of you who listen to Aretha, she has perhaps the most famous version of Mary, Don't You Weep. So that's from where this song, the title from where it comes. Take Six also has a very good version from the 1990s. But let's talk a little bit just about the kind of the gospel tradition and the ways in which the resonance of biblical scripture lives in the mind of Baldwin throughout the course of his writings.
Yes, that's an excellent question. And I just want to touch on this, when you mentioned the letter to his nephew and you said that his father was defeated, And I immediately thought, okay, why was his father defeated already? And it was because Baldwin says that he believed what white people said about him.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And if you look in another essay of Baldwin's, Baldwin talks about that, what that belief is, and he calls it a kind of theology. And so I think, you know, I just wanted to, I wanted to mention that as well. And so your question was about how the gospel tradition, in essence, shows up in Baldwin. Now, this is one fascinating aspect about Baldwin. So despite the fact that Baldwin would often say publicly, you know, in essence, that I'm not a Christian, and he would have a very strong critiques of the church, what Baldwin scholars know is that Baldwin would travel with his, you know, gospel vinyl because he wanted to listen to gospel music. If you read his literature, you find the lyrics.
Mahalia.
Yes, absolutely. You find the lyrics of gospel music all throughout his literature in this really powerful way. And then it raised the question for me at the time was a burgeoning religion scholar, why does this keep showing up? it has to have more significance than past theological commitments. There has to be something else around it. And I think for Baldwin, in many ways, and this is something I talk about in the second chapter of my book, is that for Baldwin, Black life is not a matter of phenotype. Black life is a matter of sound. Blackness is carried in what he calls the beat. And so Baldwin would say, in order to write his life, in order to properly remember his life, he needed that song, because that was his story. That's the story of Black folks. Baldwin might have said, I don't have much thought for the theological claims being made in gospel music, but that wasn't the point. The point is what he says in Many Thousands Gone, which is that Black folks told their narrative. One of the primary ways they told their narrative was through song. And that was the way in which Black life was knit together in Baldwin's mind. So Baldwin, when I ever imagine Baldwin, he's always just kind of moving and writing in a sea of sound, because he thought Black writers were attempting to do what artists like Aretha Franklin, what Bessie Smith and others were doing. He was like, no, that's what we're trying to do, right? Musicians are doing something else. They're on a whole other level. Writers are trying to touch that. And so that's why I think it's so important to realize why music plays such a huge role in Baldwin's lit.
There's a whole generation of them. I mean, obviously Aretha, but Sam Cooke and Marvin Gaye come out of that tradition. Mm-hmm. And when they move into the pop world, it begins to wreak havoc on their sensibilities as kind of secular people versus yes. the ways in which they were trained. We'll see that kind of crisis in a number of Baldwin examples. Yes. I'm going to just kind of linger a little bit more on the aspect of sound and music. Baldwin, there isn't quite a soundtrack to Baldwin's novels, I would say, or his fiction, but musicians pop up quite frequently. The most famous, of course, is Rufus Scott and From Another Country, which is an overwrought novel in a way with too many tentacles. But Rufus Scott is a drummer. He's a musician, and he's troubled and has his own demons. And I forget the woman with whom he has affair the first time.
Leona.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. right. The Southern Belle, mm-hmm. who's looking for an adventure in the big city. Mm-hmm. And then Richard and Vivaldo and that complex thing. But after reading your book, I was prompted to rethink the Rufus character. What if Baldwin, so he commits suicide mm-hmm. and he dies at the base of the George Washington Bridge. And I was thinking to myself, what if that is a kind of sacrifice? What if he gone through this kind of metaphorical baptism that he's the one who's not saved, but all the other characters are saved, including his sister? Yeah. So like, what are the ways in which Rufus becomes a kind of stand-in for not the messianic figure, mm-hmm. right, but the kind of sacrificial figure mm-hmm. who then offers salvation to, because their lives get really entangled and entwined together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rufus is a fascinating character to me because I was thinking of the early scene in the novel, and it's been a little time since I've read it, but I do remember specifically in one of the opening performances in which Rufus is playing. Rufus is a drummer, if I'm remembering correctly. And in essence, during the song, Baldwin said it was like the musicians were screaming, what was the phrase, "Do you love me?" over and over and over and over again. And then after that performance, then Rufus's life continues to unravel as he gets entangled in the relationship with this white woman, etc. And I think for Baldwin was trying to highlight, it reads in a similar fashion to the messaging of Giovanni's Room, of what happens when we don't believe ourselves worthy of love and cannot recognize the love that we are receiving, and also all of the roadblocks society places on Black folks in particular that would lead us to believe that we are unlovable. Because the artist for Baldwin is, if Rufus is playing those drums, Rufus is sharing his life while he's playing. That's how Baldwin views the artist. And the question I had was, perhaps Rufus died because folks weren't hearing his song. Mm. He was trying. He was screaming, "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" And then at the end, realized, no, they don't. And also, I think there is something to this kind of sacrificial metaphor within the text itself, because I agree with you. I don't think it's necessarily messianic, but at the same time, I'm thinking, you know, I think Baldwin might be toying with some messianic themes, because I think I love that Baldwin does not, if he is pulling on Christ narratives and things like that, Rufus does not come out of the water. There is no resurrection. There's death, and then there's the aftermath. And I think that's a profound statement around the Christ narrative that makes a lot of folks uncomfortable, because folks want to jump to Sunday and the resurrection and life and happiness. It's like, no, Rufus was dead and he remained dead. And the character still, in some way, and I'm not saying that I necessarily, you know, get on board with myths of redemptive suffering, but somehow that death contributed to the liberation of the other characters. And this is a recurring theme in Baldwin's work around redemptive suffering, and, you know, which has been, you know, Black feminists have critiqued the hell out of that, but it's there.
The Giovanni's Room has a character named David. It's his 1956 novel. It's the second one. It's one that's set in Europe primarily. And the part that you're mentioning is that there's all kinds of homophobia that's being hurled at them. His lover is why his lover's name is Giovanni. Mm-hmm. Very sexy. And but David has his own kind of internalized shame. Yes. Actually more than shame.
Yes.
And it loathes himself. Mm-hmm. In a way that when they're intimate and they're like they're having sex and they're fucking and they're getting, and he wants to purge himself, he wants to purify himself.
Yes. I mean, it's like, he wants to get clean. Yeah, he wants to get clean. And then, you know, Giovanni's talking about this. You hate, you know, Giovanni at one point says, "You hate Giovanni because I make you stink." Right? And, you know, he's meaning that both literally and metaphorically. Like, you want to stay clean. You want to engage me, but you don't want to get dirty. Yeah, absolutely. And David, I think you're right. It's touching on a very similar theme in that David is reflective for me of Baldwin's message of, when we fail to love, to embrace the love of the other, it doesn't just kill us. It has the potential to kill the other as well. Because, you know, spoiler alert, the novel does not end well for Giovanni. Giovanni dies. And in essence, Baldwin is saying, like, no, this is what happens when we are unable to love, to give and receive it. And David was unable to give and receive it because he was too obsessed with his white US American masculinity to get dirty with Giovanni.
The, you know, Baldwin's novels, as many of you know, have fairly simple plot structures that get unnecessarily entangled and because they're overwrought with too many characters. I'm just saying that as a literature professor. You have different opinions. But you know, after I was reading your book, you know, I returned, so the first novel, which we will get to, because yes, this is the kind of Pentecostal fire.
Oh, right? Yes, absolutely.
It's like, it's Fire and Brimstone, it's a Go Tell on the Mountain, it's a semi-autobiographical novel from 1953, the last novel is 1979. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of transformation in Baldwin from 53 to 79, but I'm thinking about, after again reading your book, which I admire a great deal, like the last novel, which we will get to after we talk about the first novel, you know, in some respects kind of takes all of the other elements from the first ones and melts them all together.
I agree, right? Absolutely.
The last novel is just above my head, 1979, but the first novel, let's go back to the locus classicus, as it were, Go Tell It on the Mountain, 1953, which features a young teenager named John Grimes. You know, there in my field, there have been many critics who have argued that the genre that we call the Bildungsroman, the novel and story of maturation, the things that we kind of attach to Jane Austen or Charles Dickens, like like the histories of racial violence against Black people in the U.S. disallows that genre for being so. Like, Pacola Breedlove and The Bluest Eye can't live. It's a genre that's unavailable to Black American writers. This is one that's he's a teenager. He's on the precipice of, like, physically of adulthood.
Yes.
He has a conflicted relationship with his biological father. He has an even more conflicted relationship with his stepfather, who is Gabrielle Grimes. In fact, he has a biblical name. And he's a holy roller. He's deep in the groove, as it were. And I wonder if you could just, like, walk us through what happens with us in this semi-autographical work that aspires to be Bielan's Roman, but can't, and what the function of the kind of his representation of the Pentecostal church is doing there.
Yes. Yeah, so, Go Tell on the Mountain is, you know, considered by many to be his greatest novel. I don't know if I agree with that, but I can see why that is the claim. What is fascinating about this novel is John Grimes, he's 14 years old. It starts on his birthday. And John is kind of overwhelmed. He lives in this kind of the sea of anxiety at all times. And in essence, the question that's driving the novel is, will this young man enter into the world of the Pentecostal church, which up to that point he had rejected? Or is this young man going to leave the church and go out into the world, which his community says is kind of a space of condemnation, damnation, evil? So he wakes up on his 14th birthday. He's thinking about his own burgeoning sexuality. He was thinking about how he engaged in self-pleasure, thinking about the other young men at school. And then he's, like, consumed with all this guilt of, like, I'm such a depraved sinner. I'm so dirty. There's all this imagery of filth within the novel itself, especially as John is reflecting on himself. Also, Gabriel Grimes, his stepdad, is often talking about filth and depravity and evil and things of that nature. What's really interesting about this novel, though, is it doesn't stay with John long. The novel jumps backwards to talk about his father and his father's story, because Baldwin believed that our stories are never our own. We carry our ancestor stories within us, and until we can contend with those histories, then we cannot contend with and face our own lives. So it made sense to me that he would, you know, leave John in the present and then jump backwards to talk about Gabriel, and showing Gabriel's story from this, he goes from this incredible, he's an incredibly wild young man who spends all of his time having sex, drinking, fighting, etc., has a conversion experience, and then is transformed. Now, what he is transformed into is not an image of Jesus as Gabriel claims, but he turns into an awful, abusive, terrifying human being who lives to judge other people, particularly little John. And so Gabriel thinks he is, you know, the closest thing to the divine. At times, I think Gabriel thinks that he is God himself, because for Gabriel, it would be a himself. And you go through Gabriel's story and you get towards the end and you have this moment where John is faced with the decision. Now, I teach a course on Baldwin at Colorado College, and my students, they get to the end, they're anticipating what's going to happen. They're like, oh yeah, this young man's about to just step out, leave the church, give it a middle finger on the way out. It's going to be over. And then he has this conversion experience and he's converted. And that is, in essence, where the novel ends. And my students hate it. They hate it. They're like, oh my God, this turned into a tragedy. What happened? But I think there's a lot there. I think there's a reason why Baldwin let that young man be converted, because I think any other decision would have not been true, because that was his story. He didn't leave it then. No, he dove all the way in. He doesn't leave it for years, few years after that. But that's, in essence, the general narrative of Go Tell on the Mountain.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you're using some kind of languages around, you know, metamorphosis. Mm. Conversion and transformation just came up in the last response. But those are homologies and they're not synonyms. And one is deeply embedded with some kind of religious connotation, conversion. There's lots of transformations in almost all of the stories,
yes.
But fewer conversions. And so I wonder if we could just, where do we see kind of religious awakenings, conversions happening in Baldwin.
Mm-hmm. I think I often read Baldwin's transformations as types of conversions. And the reason I think that is because, so take for instance the one of my favorite moments in any of Baldwin's literature, which is the first time Arthur and Crunch in the novel Just Above My Head have their first sexual experience with one another. Just Above My Head is a large, somewhat unruly novel. Where, you know, I tell my students, like, if you're going to read it, you got to be ready to dive in. It's as thick as the Bible. And it's a long narrative outlining the life of Arthur Montana, who was a gospel singer who becomes a soul singer, and talking about the kind of, in essence, it traces Arthur's life and his relationship to his brother Hall Montana, but then also there's other characters like a young black man by the name of Crunch, Julia, a young child evangelist, etc. Arthur is a young queer man. Crunch is as well. And so they are in this gospel quartet singing throughout the South, and they have their first sexual experience with one another. What's fascinating about this is, you know, it's a beautiful scene, very graphically rendered. And what Baldwin does during the scene, as they are kind of facing the naked bodies of one another, is, as Baldwin does, a gospel song starts, and he frames the entire scene around this gospel song as they are having sex for the first time. And I read this and I'm just like, okay, what is he communicating here? The scene reads like an extended conversion experience. All the hallmarks of conversion are there, right? This moment of terror, who am I? But the terror wasn't before a God, it was before the other person in front of them, as they're facing the naked body of the other. And then there was immediately this call for confession. And the confession was like, no, this is my desire. I'm going to own this as my desire. This is who I am. And those two young men had to be so bold to engage one another in that moment. And think about this, they were having sex in the Deep South during this time. This was dangerous for black folks in general, let alone black queer folks. And then they begin to engage in sex. There's climax. And then Arthur is talking about how he is transformed, how all taste will be forever changed because of what he tasted in that moment. He left that moment very different as a character than before it. And so it read like, this is why I talk about Baldwin disidentifying with Christian theology, because what Baldwin did, he didn't reject conversion wholesale. What he did was he just retooled it and he reworked it. And to use theological language, he transfigured it in that moment from symbolizing a person entering into a life of faith in the Christian church to a person, in essence, embracing their queerness and engaging with another person in such a way that transformed them radically. And I think that's what was so beautiful about this moment. It was like, no, folks got saved, but it had nothing to do with God. He didn't need God in that moment. What he needed was the body of the other. That was what was sacred. That was what was holy. That was what was ultimate in that moment.
You know, one of the striking, it is a big novel, it's this last one, mm-hmm. but one of the striking features of it is that it's one of the few moments where we see black love.
Mm. Yes.
Baldwin is kind of overwrought with interracial love.
Yes.
But mm-hmm. just the radical possibility of seeing two black men, mm-hmm. you don't even need love. You can just have desire. Yes. It's just like have something that is even approximating intimacy mm-hmm. is a radical act to depict in fiction. That, mm-hmm. In some respects, even now. Yes. Right? But I wonder if we can talk just a little bit like Arthur and Crunch, mm. right? They're in a group called the Emperor's Soul. It's amazing, but and they come from different kind of socioeconomic. But like, how or why did it take Baldwin this long to get to that valence of black love? There are many valences of black love. So let me put that out there, right?
Yeah.
But because the only other one really is If Beale Street Could Talk.
Exactly.
Right, with Tish and Fonny.
Mm-hmm. Why did it take so long? That's an excellent question that I don't know if I necessarily have an answer to. Part of me wonders if Just Above My Head, in essence, was reflective of a kind of a wish fulfillment that Baldwin did not necessarily ever experience himself. Baldwin's relationships were consistently plagued by, in essence, so-called failure. I think Baldwin wrote just above my head to be his, in essence, kind of final song. So it only makes sense to me that he would choose to show such a profoundly loving relationship between two Black men at the end of his story, because I think that was reflective of, you know, what Baldwin was pursuing his entire life. But I would also say too, love for Baldwin is not a kind of fluffy sentimentality. Those two young men have sex, their lives are transformed, and Crunch dies brutally. And I think for Baldwin, it is always about seizing these very particular moments in which one finds life, knowing that they are, in essence, fleeting. But I don't know if that answers your question, but I think it's in essence,
hypothetical.
Because I think in essence, like with him knowing that, you know, I think on some level Baldwin, you know, I don't think he thought it was going to be his last work, because he still had projects he was working on, but it reads as though it is kind of like a final message. And so it makes sense to me that he would center Black love, particularly to Black men, in the ways that he does, as kind of the quintessential symbol of transformation and the possibility for love in the world, even if marked by sometimes the tragic.
I just want to return back by way of closing to Chicago again and The Fire Next Time. Baldwin, so many of his novels, there's some that are set in Italy and in France, but there's almost always a kind of binary unit of Greenwich Village and Harlem. So there's a kind of contrapuntal or kind of bifurcation of New York City, of Manhattan, between what happens above 125th and what happens in the village. That bifurcation is not unknown here in Chicago, still, unfortunately. But in The Fire Next Time, the second essay. We're talking a lot about Christianity, you know, a little bit about spirituality as a whole, but in the second essay, that's when we encounter Baldwin meeting Elijah Muhammad. And so he's encountering the Nation of Islam.
Yes.
Yeah, right. And walk us through that mm-hmm. that episode a little mm-hmm. bit.
Yeah. So the reason that ended up in, you know, The Fire Next Time was because Baldwin was commissioned by another publication to write a piece on the Nation of Islam. He decided, well, I'm not going to write it for them. I'm going to put it. Baldwin had a tendency to do that. Decided, well, I'm not going to write it for them anymore. I'm going to put it here. And so he had Baldwin over the years had a lot of engagement, particularly with Malcolm X. But then there's this one scene in The Fire Next Time where James Baldwin is invited to the home of Elijah Muhammad on the south side of Chicago. He's invited to dinner, and it's such a beautiful piece of narrative. And as he's kind of pulling you into the experience, you go into the home, he sees all the women who are veiled and they're working, and then he's brought before Elijah Muhammad, and he is just so taken with this man. Like, he thinks he's magical. Then he's like, no, I see why people are falling into the nation in this way, because this man he's so compelling. And they sit down and they have dinner and they're talking about, he said, as Elijah Muhammad would often do, he would often ping pong comments off of other people at the table. And he was, you know, he's talking about the white man and the evils of the white man, and people are bouncing those comments back. And Baldwin, in essence, is being challenged with a kind of come to Jesus moment of, are you going to embrace this message? And Baldwin is so honest in The Fire Next Time and saying, like, you know, like he was tempted. He's like, then they were joking, like, perhaps next time we meet you, we'll be greeting you as James X, right? And he was like, yes, perhaps. But he said that he knew a bit too much about theology to embrace that messaging. He's like, something feels familiar about this messaging that portrayed white people as inextricably evil, all evil and bound for destruction, and then Black people as divine and a reflection of Allah himself. Baldwin in The Fire Next Time thinks, like, no, this sounds like, you know, sinners will be bound and thrown into hell for 1,000 years. This sounds like a kind of reversal of even something like the myth of Ham. And Baldwin said, because I know the Bible so well, I cannot get on board. And Baldwin is a bit self-conscious during that meet. We were talking about this just a minute ago, that he left that dinner to go and meet some white folks in another part of Chicago. And he knew when he gave him the address that they were going to know, oh, he's leaving to meet some white people. And he was just like, oh, man. And so, but Baldwin said that he, as he was standing outside on the porch with Elijah Muhammad and they were looking out, you know, over the south side of Chicago, Baldwin was fearful that the next time they met, he might be his enemy. Because Baldwin, despite the fact that Baldwin strongly disliked a lot of white folks, there were some white folks, a few that he loved, and loved enough to say, if the violence comes, if the destruction comes, I will die with them. That's very counter to the theology of Elijah Muhammad. So it was this very tense moment of what, in essence, you know, the John Grimes, what will Baldwin choose in this moment? And he got in the car and he left. And so I think it's a really powerful kind of portrait of a very particular moment of Black Chicago at the home of Elijah Muhammad, one of my favorite parts of The Fire Next Time.
This is the last question to kind of wrap it up and refer, kind of get us back to your book, which, you know, is clearly indebted to queer of color critique and Black feminist thought, liberation theology, and you know, I began by putting into high relief the discipline of religious studies and some of the kind of foundational scholarship there. On the one hand, too, you have a set of folks who've been working in literary studies.
Yes.
Magdalena Zabruska's brilliant book on Baldwin in Turkey, Dwight McBride's work on Black popular culture and Baldwin, Nicholas Boggs' very recent biography, which is kind of a biography through relationships, if you will, Robert Reed Farr's impending biography, which is exquisite, brilliant. But if you look at that arc, and you know, it probably begins with Horace Porter, who has a book in, I think, 83, 84. But like, what's the arc of the criticism of Baldwin studies to allow us to get to your book?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I think, because I'm constantly thinking about Baldwin literature, particularly in relationship to the question of religion, Black spirituality in particular. So what we saw, so even thinking about the general arc of Baldwin criticism, in scholarship on Baldwin, there weren't a lot of folks who were, because for a long time, it was just writers like Michael Lynch, a white writer who was engaging questions of Baldwin and spirituality and religion. And Michael Lynch argued that Baldwin was, in essence, a Christian, that he still believed deeply, that he was searching for, and this is what Lynch says in one article, a loving God. Then other authors come along within Baldwin criticism, folks like Clarence Hardy, Josiah Ulysses Young, L. Cornegay, who's from Chicago. They are engaging around Baldwin around the question of spirituality and religion in a very particular way. And where I locate my book is, in essence, I wanted to write what I understood to be the most robust portrait that engages the question of Baldwin and his spirituality, that does not try to decouple the spirituality from other aspects of his criticism, like sexuality, his critique of the church, his linkage of Christianity and colonialism. All these things are all interlocked. So to engage Baldwin and spirituality is to engage the whole of Baldwin's thought. And I know, of course, you cannot engage the whole of Baldwin's thought, but what I wanted to do was have a significant portrait of Baldwin and religion in particular, because what I've seen in the arc of Baldwin scholarship is that there's only been just a handful of texts that do that type of work. Douglas Field is another author who engages Baldwin's spirituality, but that's where I wanted my book to land, because I think Baldwin's so committed to the continued use and deployment of Black religious symbols and language that you cannot understand Baldwin's corpus without having a robust understanding of Black spirituality, Black Christianity, and his past relationship to those things. And that's what I wanted to offer.
There you have it.
Yeah, thank you.
The microphones are being passed around.
Thank you so much for this. It's been really fantastic. I want to go back to where you both started and ask you, because you talked so much about metamorphosis and conversion and these themes in Baldwin's work, and it sounded a little bit to me like that was what his work offered you in your academic trajectory and moving from a school of theology into, you know, Colorado College and a religious studies department. And I'm just wondering if you can talk more. You just spoke very eloquently about where this work sits in the field of Baldwin studies, but I'm wondering where this work sits in the field of your studies and sort of how your engagement with religion and literature and what's coming next and and that, you know, the way in which literature has maybe moved you in a different direction, the questions that you're asking.
That's great. So in essence, Baldwin in essence provided a map for me, not just intellectually, but personally. Because, you know, the academic study of religion, especially in the places that I engaged in the work, I was constantly being faced with the ways in which Christianity is entangled in the guts of modernity in such a way that colonialism is a Christian phenomenon. The birth of whiteness is a Christian phenomenon. Genocide of many peoples was a Christian phenomenon. And I'm sitting there and I'm realizing these things and I'm like, what do I do with this? And then I read Baldwin, and I was thinking even in The Fire Next Time specifically, where Baldwin is, a lot of folks don't talk about this part of The Fire Next Time, where he just makes this bold claim of that Christianity has nothing to do with Jesus, that Christianity is often served as an excuse for what he says is the planting of the flag, colonial excursions, the seizing of bodies, land, etc. And so I read it and I'm like, yep, this is why I cannot do this anymore. But at the same time, I was a child of the Black church. I came of age in Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church in central Indiana. I would not have survived to now without those men, and I would say mostly women, who came alongside me and said, this child's gonna live. And they gave me a language and they gave me a story and they taught me about Blackness. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, what do I do with that story? Because I can't reject that. I might reject Christianity, but I can't reject those folks. And Baldwin, again, provided a roadmap. And saying like, no, you don't have to hold to the theological claims, but you can talk about the power of Black communal life, Black social life, and how Blackness is we've survived in this country because of those communities of people that poured life into one another. As we exchanged, as Baldwin was talking about, as he's preaching, exchanging with those in the audience, sharing their life, sharing their suffering and their life became his own and his became theirs. Because I was also a teenage preacher, like James Baldwin. I started preaching at 17 in Black churches. What do I do with that? And so he provided that roadmap as well. And so I've been walking with Baldwin for a long time, not just intellectually, but personally, I needed him for that moment.
Okay, thanks again for just being here and sharing your perspective.
Thank you.
After your last comment, this question sparked up. Maybe it's a big question, but you know, answer as you can.
Yeah.
How have you, or how should one reconcile their faith in queerness?
So, yeah, I mean, that is a big question, and part of it comes down to how one understands the meaning of terms like faith, spirituality, religion. My definition of religion tends to lean heavily on folks like Charles Long, who talk about religion as that which provides orientation, which has so much resonance with queer discourse, like orientation. In essence, I often think of it as a kind of the anchor point, right? And it informs, your religion is a reflection of that which provides meaning. And I think about, where do I find that meaning? It's in queer community, particularly with Black queer friends, Black relationships of so many different types that have provided me orientation, because queerness for me is not simply a reflection of the folks that I might be attracted to, but it informs my politics. It informs how I engage in relationships, how I rupture traditional relationship styles, all of those things, it does provide a profound orientation. That's how I reconcile those things. But also I think about Baldwin. Baldwin didn't throw notions like transformation in the trash. Baldwin, I think, recognized that in the church, there's all this talk of change, metamorphosis, becoming a new creature. I think Baldwin still pursued those things. He didn't think the church was the space to find it. He's like, who transformed me? Lucian, his lover, transformed him. And he said that, and I think Baldwin would say, like, sex for Baldwin wasn't, he's like, don't disparage it. Yeah, sometimes it is just fucking, that's fine. But it can also be something that changes you. If you will look on and embrace the humanity of the other standing in front of you. And so I think that is, you know, that's how I reconcile those things. It doesn't look like my upbringing in the church, but it also makes me say that my kin, my relationships are holy and transform me daily.
So I'm thinking about the prior two questions. One, Baldwin's autobiographical notes, right? I don't believe in any creeds or theories. I believe they all should be pulverized. Thinking about that in reconciliation, which was a great question, but also thinking about your question about interventions. And so you laid out at the outset that in the religious discourse, particularly the academic study of it, Baldwin is often talked about by Black men as a closeted Christian who at some point might come to realization. I think Cone goes a little bit further before he passed away in speaking about him, like, well, he just didn't know, which is a critique Cone has had on multiple, a response Cone has had on multiple folks. So as I'm thinking about all that in the questions, how do you see your text as an intervention into that space? And then following up, like, what's next then if we begin to expand those categories, pulverize them, ultimately begin to expand and make more space? How do you see your text doing that in an academic sense?
Oh, excellent question. And I knew this. I knew my dear friend Stephen Reedus, who for years it was one of my primary conversation partners around James Baldwin. We actually met at the seminary co-op while I was looking for Baldwin text years ago, and so I knew he was going to drop a. I think in many ways, what I was trying to do was take Baldwin at his word. If Baldwin said that, you know, in essence, one of his final conversations with his biographer, David Lemming, and he said, I don't believe in God. I'm going to take Baldwin at his word. And I'm not going to write an entire text that says, maybe he was just mistaken. It's like, no, that was his claim. And that's an important claim. And we need to sit with that. And then we can think about, well, what does that mean then in relationship to his continued use of these symbols and this language and et cetera, these songs? And so I think what I was trying to do was, in essence, to be honest about Baldwin in that way and to take seriously the claims he makes from even early on in some of his early essays, where this man, in essence, even in Preservation of Innocence from 1949, says that God is, in essence, it's like Baldwin was reading Feuerbach or something, in essence, saying that God is an outgrowth of the human psyche. In essence, we create God. And that theme would show up again and again and again in Baldwin's literature and saying, like, no, we create our deities. In the aftermath of the bombing of the Birmingham church, when he's in a conversation with Reinhold Niebuhr, he says, well, perhaps it's time for us to give Christ a new face because we create our deities. I wanted to be honest that if Baldwin's saying that stuff, then he meant it, right? I can't talk to him. So I want to be very honest about that. So I think that's one intervention I wanted to make was, you know, I wanted to, and I'm not the only one, because I think Josiah Ulysses Young, I think he does an excellent job in problematizing the ways in which people try to Christianize, because he says it right at the beginning of his book. Like, I don't think Baldwin necessarily believed in God in any way that we might come up with. It was something different there. I think Clarence Hardy does as well. I think Cornegay is doing a different project, and I think Cornegay would argue that Baldwin was a Christian. I disagree with him on that. I was sometimes quite mean about it. But that's the case. So I think that's the intervention. But I would also say too, I think from here, but one thing Baldwin has inspired me to do is to think about the the spirituality of Black queerness in a broad sense, because I think that's what Baldwin is pointing to throughout his, and especially in Just Above My Head. It's like, no, this isn't just sex. There is something else here. And I want to think about Black queer life and the ways in which Black queer folks create meaning together, experience meaning together, whether that's through touch, whether that's through laughter, however that may look. I want to be thinking about those things. And so that's the direction my work is taking, and I have a piece that I'm working on currently that puts Charles Long into conversation with the queer theorist, feminist writer Sarah Ahmed, both of their understandings of orientation and what does that mean? What is the orientation of Black queer spirituality? And so that's what I'm thinking about.
Well, thank you both for this wonderful conversation. If we can have a round of applause for our speakers.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.